Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does a person who is not religious gain from reading the Bible? David Plotz was a 36-year-old, self-described, proud but not terribly observant Jew when he decided for the first time in his life to read the Hebrew Bible, what Christians call the Old Testament, from cover to cover. He approached the reading without looking to reinforce any particular religious doctrine and without benefit of scholarly interpretation. He also wrote down his gut responses to what he describes as a bawdy, violent, sexy, and sarcastic narrative. Along the way, Plotz discovered some confounding contradictions between the God of the Torah and the actions that he took. He also found rich insight into human morality and sacred ideals. David Plotz is the editor of Slate Magazine, which originally ran his observations as a series called Blogging the Bible. His book based on the experience is called Good Book, The Bizarre, Hilarious, Disturbing, Marvelous, and Inspiring Things I Learned When I Read Every Single Word of the Bible. David, welcome back to Think.
Thanks very much, Chris.
This all started with Dinah. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yes. So I was at bat mitzvah of my cousin a few years ago, and it was a really long and extremely boring bat mitzvah. No offense to you, Cousin Alina. But I was sitting there thinking about what to do, and I saw a Bible, a Hebrew Bible, in the pew back in front of me, and I picked it open and flipped it open at random and landed on Genesis chapter 34. I started to read, and it's the story of Dinah, who's the daughter of the great patriarch Jacob, who's obviously one of the major heroes of the Bible. And she goes out one day, and she's raped by a young man named Shechem. And Shechem, after the rape, decides actually he really loves her. He speaks to her tenderly, the Bible tells us, and really wants to marry her. So he goes to Jacob and Jacob's sons, who are Dinah's brothers, and says, hey, you know, sorry about the rape, but I love her. I want to marry her. I'll do anything. If I can marry her, you know, we'll share our land with you. You can marry the daughters of our tribe. We'll pay for your internet service, whatever it is, if I can just marry Dinah. And so Jacob's brothers say, okay, but, you know, no uncircumcised man can come into our group. So you and all the men of your town need to get circumcised before this wedding can happen. And Shechem agrees. He goes home to his town, and he and all the men of his town get circumcised. And then the story turns very dark, which is that while the men are crippled from the circumcision, while they're recovering from the surgery, Jacob's sons descend on the town, murder all these disabled men, sack the town, and take all the women and children as slaves, and then go back to Jacob and tell him what they've done. And Jacob says, well, you know, it's going to be very difficult to live in this neighborhood if you're going to be treating everybody like this. And the sons say, what, did you want our sister to be treated like a whore? And then the story ends. And I thought, when I went to Sunday school, I learned about the Garden of Eden and Noah's Ark, but rape and tricking people into circumcision, which is, of course, the great Jewish covenant, in order to disable them for slaughter, enslavement of innocent women and children, all done by the men who were the founders of Israel, who are our ancestors. And I thought, if this is here, and it's not hidden way back in some part of the Bible no one ever reads, in the book of Habakkuk or Zephaniah or something, it's right in the middle of Genesis, the book of the Bible that even people who haven't read the Bible think they've read. If that's in there, what else did I miss in my religious education and my cultural education? And so I thought, I really need to read the book. I really need to sit down and start it in the beginning and just keep going.
Well, it's interesting when you talk about what you missed, because I think a lot of people who went to Sunday school or Hebrew school or had any kind of education feel like they know a lot of stories, but mostly we're told to focus on the ones where the moral is clear and we can take some message from it that seems to make sense.
That's exactly right. And I think one of the contrasts I try to draw in Good Book is the contrast between what I would call the Sunday school Bible and the messy Bible. And the Sunday school Bible is the Bible that we're familiar with culturally. It's what we get in Sunday school. It's what we get in just from the stories we hear from our parents or on television, or that you pick up here and there. And it's filled with moral lessons and great heroes, and it's all supervised by a kind and loving and compassionate God. The The messy Bible, which is what is actually there in the Bible, is much more complicated and much more difficult and disturbing, and the moral lessons are not at all certain. So to take one example, Jacob, who is the patriarch we just talked about a second ago, comes down to us as a hero. He's the father of Israel. He wrestles an angel. He's deeply beloved of God. And his brother Esau, his twin brother Esau, comes down to us as kind of the villain of the story and the conflict between these two brothers. And then you actually read the Bible, and there's a fight between Jacob, who's the younger twin, and Esau, for their father's blessing and for their birthright, and just this conflict between these brothers. And you realize that Esau is the very image of what we think of a kind of moral hero to be. He is loving. He is forgiving. He's kind. He has brotherly love. Whereas his brother Jacob is a trickster, a con artist, a schemer, and yet who's the one that God favors? Who's the one that God loves? It turns out to be Jacob. So it's quite confounding to see that the messy Bible and the Sunday school Bible often don't really have much to do with each other.
Well, what do you think is the reason then that most of the religions of the world that use the Bible focus on not the messy Bible, but the things that we sort of all agree are correct, even though maybe there are more stories in the Bible that seem to present these conflicts and these elevate people whose morals don't seem to fix with what we believe is right?
Well, I do think I don't want to make it seem as though that I come away from this, you know, appalled at the Bible. I, by no means at all, quite the reverse. It is a book which is inspiring and awesome in every possible way. It's just that it's not inspiring and awesome in the way that we think it is. And I do think that what Jews in particular have discovered, I think for Christians came up with a really wonderful solution for the problems of the Bible, of the Old Testament, which is that there's a New Testament in which you have a God and Jesus, a God figure, who are loving and compassionate, and that the moral lessons are really quite clear in there. I think for what's happened with Jews is that we sort of have a lot of arguments, and we spend a lot of time on the Talmud and on the commentaries and just sort of fighting about these stories, and I think for Jews, this kind of moral argument has become, in a way, what the religion is that we're struggling with this because the stories on the page are so difficult. We'll struggle with it in this form of argument, and I think that we obviously the reason why, you know, the nice things and the better things come down to us is that it would be if you had a religion which was based on, you know, the laws of Leviticus, let's say, really based on the laws of Leviticus, it would be impossible to abide by it in our modern world. People just couldn't stand it. They'd be stoning people at every second. They'd be, you know, killing people who were working on the Sabbath in every minute. And that would not, it wouldn't be a society that would work for us. So I think we've had to seek out the sort of softer side of the Bible.
You ultimately write that the Bible, although you came away with a great fondness for it, it didn't bring you closer to God. Did you hope at the outset that maybe that would be sort of a fringe benefit of this exploration of the text?
I hoped that because I think I'm an agnostic and I, as I write in Good Book, I came to the Bible as a very hopeful agnostic, and I left a kind of despairing agnostic because God so rarely lived up to my hopes of what he would be. I think for anybody it's impossible not to read the Bible and think about questions of your own faith. And I'm deeply grateful for the experience because it forced me into a conversation with God. I mean, So even though I don't come away with more solace and comfort from the Bible, I come away much more engaged with the moral and the moral questions about faith than I did before I started it.
Yeah. So you say a conversation with God. Is that sort of God as a concept as opposed to God as a personified figure in any sense of the word?
I guess it is. God is an interesting character in the Bible, which is that he is sometimes he's very much a person who's there, who's present. He'll walk through the Garden of Eden literally, or one great occasion he drops in at Abraham's tent like some kind of sitcom neighbor. He just like, oh, I'm stopping by. I'm on my way to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah. How's it going? And then at other occasions he's very distant. He appears as smoke or as fire or not at all, that we can't possibly hope to comprehend him. I think the God that I engage with is a God who is a notion rather than has some kind of physical existence.
When you started doing this, you didn't arm yourself with a variety of texts that would sort of explain what was going on. Were there times when the Bible was difficult to understand, when the things they were talking about didn't make any sense to you as a 21st century American?
That happened quite frequently. I mean, and again, this is when I get to the contrast between the messy Bible and the Sunday school Bible. You know, when they teach you the Bible in Sunday school, they don't, for example, going to the book of Leviticus, which is the third book in the Bible, no one ever talks about the fact that the first half of this book, there are 13 chapters which are about animal sacrifices and how to do them, and about leprosy, and sort of what to do when someone has leprosy, and who gets leprosy, and how they should be treated. And it's just weird to read it. It just, you know, it's totally alienating and confounding. At the same time, we have all this weirdness there, of course. You know, I guess what's remarkable about the Bible is that at once it feels deeply alien, deeply like this was written in a culture with which we are not incredibly familiar, which is not like ours. At the same time, there are these people in the Bible. King David, I think, is being the paramount example. Moses is another one, who are so recognizably human, who are such rich characters. I mean, King David as a character is, you know, as rich as anything that's in Shakespeare or Dostoevsky, and as complicated and, you know, as fully realized. And so that interesting contrast between the sort of customs, the sort of weird customs described in the Bible, and the fact that, oh, these are people who are like us. They are men like us and women like us.
How challenging was it for you to separate out what the Bible says about the people from whom it arose in terms of their time and their culture, as opposed to what it says about all of humankind?
I think, you know, just elaborate on my answer a second ago, there are all of these wonderfully recognizable human beings in the Bible. And that for me, the most thrilling and moving parts of the Bible are seeing these people, is the identification with these people. So Abraham is one person who is, you know, who talks back to God and questions God and raises moral questions that we, you know, that we grapple with today. Another example of this is in Leviticus. Again, not to belabor it, it is weirdly my favorite book, even though everyone thinks it's incredibly boring. In Leviticus, there are terrible laws. At the same time, there are laws which you read and you think the U.S. Constitution should be so lucky to have laws like this, that we would be blessed to live in a society where these were the laws that guided us. So I do think that as much as there's things that are hard to follow, there are things which are living and breathing and deeply recognizable.
David Plotz is my guest. He is the editor of Slate Magazine. You can find them at slate.com. His new book is called Good Book, The Bizarre, Hilarious, Disturbing, Marvelous, and Inspiring Things I Learned When I Read Every Single Word of the Bible. We'll return to our conversation in a moment and welcome you to join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can get ahead in today's tough economy with hundreds of courses beginning this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. David Plotz is my guest. He is editor of Slate Magazine. His new book is called Good Book, The Bizarre, Hilarious, Disturbing, Marvelous, and Inspiring Things I Learned When I Read Every Single Word of the Bible. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. David, a lot of people debate whether or not the Bible should be required reading for students, if nothing else, as a sort of cultural study. Do you think that reading the Bible by itself, without being told anything else about it, is enough to convert most people to any sort of faith if they don't have it already?
And I hadn't thought about it in phrasing that way. I do not think that reading the Bible without kind of instruction and spiritual guidance is likely to convert people to a particular faith. That said, I think it would be very hard to teach it in American schools, American public schools, without some form of proselytizing entering into it. Yet at the same time, I do think that the Bible must be taught. I think it's quite shocking, in fact, that we allow children to grow up without a grounding in this book, which is as fundamental, more fundamental, I suppose, to what our culture is than anything except, you know, perhaps the Constitution. I think that as we make children read Shakespeare, as we make them read Mark Twain, they should have to read the Bible and they should have to know the Bible as they, you know, as they did a century ago, as all educated Americans did a century ago. And it has several uses. I mean, it has obviously the use that it makes you literate in your culture, most of all, that you finally see, oh, this is the source of the language that I use. Here are the source of these ideas about morality and or even the kind of laws that we follow. They begin in the Bible, and it's absolutely bizarre that we don't teach children that. And I think, you know, there's a second, useful use for people who are not particularly religious, which is that there are a huge number of Americans who look to the Bible for guidance on how they live their lives and how they think about particular political and social issues. And if you, as a fellow citizen, don't understand where these Bible-believing citizens are coming from, then you are incapable of having a reasonable discussion with them. And I do think that we owe it to each other as citizens to attempt to understand, oh, here's the root of my friend's beliefs about this or that issue.
Did you gain any understanding as to the fact that people who cherish the Bible and look to it as a guide can come to such radically different conclusions about what it actually means, depending on their faith?
Of course, they can, and they do. And I mean, coming back to this messy Bible, Sunday school Bible contrast that I was drawing, which is that the Bible, one of the things that is most wonderful about the Bible, and one reason why I always, you know, I tell people who say they couldn't possibly read the Bible, oh, no, of course you can, because there's something in there for you, which is that there isn't one Bible. The Bible isn't simply a unified book where there's a neat, you know, which is all one kind of thing. It is many, many different kinds of things. So you have the stories of Genesis and Exodus. At the same time, you have law codes. You have books of prophecy. You have books of devotional poetry. You have the first advice book. Proverbs is really the first self-help book. You have an erotic poem. You have short stories. The Book of Ruth is just a beautiful short story. You have history books. And so I do think that there's a point of entry to the Bible for almost any kind of person can read the Bible and find something that they love, or they can find something that they will despise. And I think, you know, different religions, and then even within different religions, different people will come to different conclusions because different kinds of stories in the Bible will resonate with them. So it, for me, you know, Genesis chapter 18 and Leviticus chapter 18 and the Book of Ruth and Psalm 119, all of these things are things which speak to me, are kind of would be foundational to the Bible that I read and what I will teach my children. For somebody else, it will be some other, because they come from a different background or they're raised in a different faith tradition, they'll find something else there. But I do think it's that the Bible has survived for so long because there are so many different ways that each of us can read it, and that's one of its most wonderful qualities.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. The email address is think@kera.org. David Plotz is here talking about his new book, Good Book. Let's go to Tam in Rowlett. Hi, Tam.
Hello. I would just like to comment on the Jacob and Esau story. And I'm in Genesis 27, verse 41. And it says, "And Esau hated Jacob because of the blessing wherewith his father blessed him. And Esau said in his heart, 'The days of mourning for my father are at hand. Then will I slay my brother Jacob.'" Esau was a very rash person. He sold his birthright for a pot of beans. And he also had murder in his heart. So I have to disagree with your speaker there, because he said that Esau was a very kind person. Also in Proverbs, I'd like to refer him to verse 7 of the first chapter. It says, "The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. Fools despise wisdom and instruction. My son, hear the instruction of your father, and forsake not the law of your mother." The Bible is a book based on obedience, loving God with all your heart, your mind, and your soul, not perceiving him as an enemy for which we must contest on radio talk shows. Thank
you. I appreciate your call. Thank you very much. Did you find a desire to love God? Does that concept make more or less sense to you now, having gone through this project?
Actually, let me. I'd just like to kind of, if I can, just respond directly to what the caller said,
because sure.
That's a very, it's a very heartfelt and interesting and I appreciate the sentiment behind it. Just first, briefly on Esau, it's absolutely true that said of Esau, but I mean, I think the caller will remember that when it is Esau who forgives Jacob, Jacob doesn't want. Esau has been done a terrible wrong by Jacob, and Jacob, you know, has no forgiveness. He's always scheming against Esau, but Esau wholeheartedly, willingly, you know, cheerfully forgives his brother in a way that is profoundly moving. And then on the point that we're to be obedient, I think that that one of the most important things that I took away from the Bible is that we are not to be obedient, and that if you look at the Bible, the people who are God's greatest favorites, who are to me, or you know, who appear as the most heroic and admirable characters, they are the people who are not the most faithful. They're the people who are the most doubting, and the people who question God. And so there is no, you know, this is Abraham telling God that he mustn't murder the innocent people of Sodom and Gomorrah, that if there are innocent people there, God must not kill them, when God had been planning to do it. It's Abraham arguing with, it's that Moses arguing with God about whether God should destroy the Israelites who've done some wrong. It's Job arguing over justice with God. It's the prophet Gideon arguing over whether insisting that God give him proof of his before he will go and fight a particular war for him. So I think it's that kind of questioning is in fact essential to faith and essential to what the Bible teaches us. And as to the question about love, there of course. You know, I think for Christians, as I said earlier, I do think this is a much easier task. That loving God is much easier when you have Jesus and when you have the story of Jesus Christ, and is the God of the Old Testament is much less loving. I still, there were times when I. When the emotion I was feeling for God was love, and there were times when it wasn't. I think it's a very heightened relationship, and so there were times when it was love, and there were times when it was I was just questioning and doubtful and quite angry. So I think it was a mix.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next to Kevin in Dallas. Hi, Kevin.
Yes. Hey, thank you for having me on.
Sure.
I wanted to just make a couple of statements about at least my study from the Bible. I study from an Israelite point of view, and so that's keeping the Old and the New Testament. So it's a slightly different perspective than most Christians come up under the blood of Jesus Christ, etc., but at the same time keeping the Old Testament laws and covenants. In reading the Bible the way that we approach our study is line upon line, precept upon precept, here a little, there a little. And you let the Bible interpret the Bible. And so if it's written, a subject or a tenet is written somewhere in Proverbs, you should be able to find that in a couple of different places. Taking that approach, and you let the Bible confirm the Bible, I think it brings a whole new meaning to how you go ahead and approach the Bible. The other piece I wanted to get some comment on is, as you read the Old Testament, it's written in the Scripture, Jesus said in the New Testament, that I come in the volume of the book. There were stories about Jesus coming all throughout the Old Testament, talking about what he was going to do. So it's not like Jesus just came along in the New Testament, so that would make it harder for individuals to deal with or comprehend the Bible because they didn't have that Jesus perspective. He's throughout the Old Testament. I just want to get your thoughts on that.
Thanks for your call, Kevin.
That's a very good point that Kevin makes about the Jesus being prefigured in the Old Testament. I mean, that's very much the Jewish view is not that. The Jewish view is that there is a Messiah who's described, but Jews don't believe that it's Jesus. We believe the Messiah has not come yet. But there are, of course, plenty of mentions in the Old Testament about the Messiah who will come and what he will bring in the prophetic books in particular. And I think the relationship to the Old New Testament has the Old Testament flows into the New Testament for Christians. For Jews, obviously, because that second part of it doesn't quite work, we read those passages somewhat differently.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. An email from Steve asks, which version of the Bible did you read?
So I read several different translations because I wanted to sort of read a Jewish translation and a Christian translation, and also I wanted to read what I felt was the best translation. So I read the New Revised Standard Version, which is sort of an ecumenical Christian translation, and I read the Jewish Publication Society translation, which is a very good Jewish translation. Both of them are heavily reliant on the King James Version, which is really still the source for so much of the language and phrasing of the Bible. I mean, I think the King James has a lot of problems with it, but in terms of the language, the best language in that tends to come through in a lot of the new translations. I think it's important. I think when people are looking for a translation, it's important to look for two things. One is that you want to find something which you're going to be able to read. So there are some translations which, because of the way they're written or because they're archaic, are just too hard for us to read as modern readers, and it becomes very frustrating. At the same time, you don't want something which is written in sort of Valley Girl speak or, you know, as
and there
a,
are
as
those
a teenager.
Out there, right?
Yeah, there are those. And I think those take it too far. So I was looking for something in between, something which is written in language that is clearly accessible to us, but that isn't, you know, like it was an email. You know, I mean, I can imagine an email or an instant message version of the Bible. Someone should probably do that.
Are there particular phrases that now sort of crop into your everyday speech that you know were reinforced by having read the Bible?
Yes. Well, you have the mighty are fallen. Mm-hmm. That's one, which I never knew. Another favorite one of mine is in the writing on the wall, which I never knew what that was. You see the writing on the wall, which, of course, is this wonderful moment from the book of Daniel where wicked King Belshazzar, a ghostly hand, writes that he has been judged and found wanting and writes this on the wall of his palace. And then, indeed, that night he's killed. So that's a phrase which has special joy for me. But really, actually, my favorite example of something which is biblical, which comes down to us in in just the culture is, there's this wonderful story of King David, who, not yet King David, he's still just an aide to King Saul. And King Saul realizes that David is a great threat to him and wants to kill him and sends assassins after him. And David hears that assassins are coming after him. So he flees his house, and his wife puts in his bed a dummy shaped like David. And so the assassins come and stab the dummy while David has escaped. And you read this and you think, oh, wait, I've seen that in, you know, the kid sneaking out for the prom, that movie, or, you know, the prisoner escaping, or, you know, the assassin coming to kill the mobster. I've seen that same plot twist in 100 times, and here we have it. It begins right here in the Book of Kings, and that was, or maybe Samuel, actually, in the Book of Samuel, and that is just a lovely moment to see, oh, we can't even think up our own new plots. It's all prefigured here.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. David Plotz is my guest, talking about his new book, Good Book. Let's go next to Peter in Plano. Hello, Peter.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
So my question is, if you're going to require this in school, what class format would you put it in? Would you put it in literature? Would you put it in social studies? Hopefully not science. When we were reading in literature in high school, we read the Book of Job as sort of literature, but what would you propose, and why?
That is a extremely good question, and I think part of, you know, one thing is that I know that this is never going to happen, because I think the Supreme Court has ruled pretty emphatically that it can't be done, so I guess I have an easy out, which is that it wouldn't happen. I think it would be, you would put it most likely in an English class. Even though I don't think it would be primarily, you wouldn't be primarily reading it as literature. I guess, no, you know, do they still teach Western civilization? I mean, I had a Western civilization
class. I think in 10th grade or something.
Yeah, Western civilization. That's where you'd put it. You'd put it in Western civilization.
David Plotz.
There we go. That's the solution.
David Plotz is my guest. He's the editor of Slate Magazine and the author of a new book called Good Book, The Bizarre, Hilarious, Disturbing, Marvelous, and Inspiring Things I Learned When I Read Every Single Word of the Bible. We'll be back in a moment. You can join us by sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can get ahead in today's tough economy with hundreds of courses beginning this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. David Plotz is here. He is editor of Slate Magazine and the author of a new book called Good Book, The Bizarre, Hilarious, Disturbing, Marvelous, and Inspiring Things I Learned When I Read Every Single Word of the Bible. You can join us by sending email to think@kera.org. By the way, David, are the original Blogging the Bible series is still accessible on Slate, if people want to take a look at that first and then go check out the book.
It is still accessible. Okay. I think you can just go to Slate.com and search for my name or for Blogging the Bible, or search Blogging the Bible on Google.
And we've had several email questions about this. Can you talk just for a minute about why you chose to read what Christians consider the Old Testament, the Hebrew Bible only?
Yes, it's a great question. I felt, you know, those of you who get a chance to read Good Book will see that it's a fairly irreverent and funny and lighthearted book. I mean, I'm having a good time with this. And I felt that I could do that for the book which comes from my faith tradition, which is the Hebrew Bible. But that for me to do that for the New Testament, which was not a book I was, you know, that was in my tradition, it was not that I didn't believe, or that I didn't know enough to believe, I thought might be perceived as being unfair and insulting. And I just didn't think that was right. And I thought, you know, the kinds of things I could say writing about the book that was my book was one, you know, I felt that that was limited to the Hebrew Bible. And I felt that doing it for the New Testament wouldn't work. So I'm looking for actually a really smart, eager Christian who's sort of in a similar position as I am. You know, somebody who loves Christianity but maybe doesn't know everything that they need to know about it who could blog the New Testament for us.
I'm really fascinated, David, by the range of responses you have had from people who are who consider the Bible a seminal document in their lives. People have been either incredibly welcoming of this effort or they have been furious with you.
Right. You know, the people who are furious with me, I understand that. I mean, some people think it's insulting what I'm doing, or it's too irreverent, I'm not taking it seriously, or I'm too uneducated. And that's fine. I think that's a perfectly acceptable view to have. I think, however, there's a large contingent of, and I think most of these folks actually are evangelical Protestants, evangelical Christians, because evangelical Christians read the Bible very deeply and intimately and personally. There's a really strong tradition among Christians of doing that. And there's a large group of those folks who, I think, saw this project as something really, it reminded them of what it was like for them to read the book for the first time. It reminded them of the kind of enthusiasm and curiosity and oddness of reading this whole book at once again. And so I can't say this enough. My goal is to do nothing except show one person's experience of doing this and to capture that kind of energy and vitality that comes from seeing something exciting and new for the first time. And so, you know, for people who haven't read the Bible, I think my book is, you know, it's a great substitute. And plus, you can keep my book in the bathroom. But for people who have read the Bible, I think what my book is it's this great reminder that this thing that you see so much in church or synagogue, that you read in a particular way, that there's a different way to read it, and that there's other, you know, there's another way to kind of love it, and you can remember what it was like for you the first time you read, you know, the story of Elijah, or the first time you read the book of Ruth, and how incredibly moving and exciting that was.
Is there any part of you that envies the people who can read the entire Bible as you did and not come away as you did, disappointed with God? Who feel that their faith is strengthened and they really sort of understand the world and their place in it?
That is a really good question. Do I have envy? Huh. I guess I'm not wired that way somehow. That some of us, you know, going back to an earlier point I made, which is that the Bible is filled with lots of different kinds of books, so there's always a book for somebody. And there's certain books in the Bible that actually even seem to be put in there for people like me. There's Ecclesiastes, which is a book which isn't really about, it's a book kind of about unbelief. It's about how to live well if you're not sure that God exists, if you're not sure that there's anything but life on earth. And you read this book and you think, well, why is this here in a book about God? Here's a book which is a book for doubters. And I think that there are people, you know, different people are wired differently, and I guess I'm wired more for this kind of doubt and questioning, and so that's just the way I am. And if I could be somebody who could believe, I guess that would be wonderful, but I would be a totally different person because of it. So, and I you know, I think it's hard. I try not to. Well, let me just leave it at that.
Let's go next to Michael in Dallas. Hello, Michael.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a couple of questions, comments. One is, has the author had the opportunity to read and study the mythologies of that have been collected by Joseph Campbell that also have parallel histories, as it were, of the creation and of how so many of the cultures, the name of their, quote, tribe is the people, that's the word people, because they are the people of their particular god. And they have their whole history, creation, the other aspects of you know, parallels in the Hebrew Bible. The second is that concerning the way the prophecies, especially Isaiah, crop up in the Christian Bible, the New Testament, there is a great deal of thought to the effect that the authors, especially Mark and Paul, integrated it in. So the
I'm going to stop you there, and I do appreciate the question, but since David didn't study the New Testament, we won't put that one to him. But maybe you can talk about the parallel traditions in other creation stories and things like that.
Well, I think just on Michael's second point, it's there's a strong, you know, the many scholars believe exactly what he's saying, that the stories of Jesus, stories told about Jesus in the New Testament were written very much in the shadow of the Old Testament, that the authors looked to what the prophecies would say about the coming Messiah and told the stories about Jesus to
correspond.
Correspond with that. I have no position on it because obviously I just don't know. Yes, I mean the if you look at ancient mythologies of all kinds, you see close parallels. I mean, there are flood stories, of course, in other traditions, and creation stories, which are similar to the ones told in the Bible. And there are a lot of, there's a wonderful book called How to Read the Bible by a guy named James Kugel that came out. I read it after I finished reading the Bible, so it didn't affect me as I was doing it. But in which he, you know, he lays out how so many of the stories told in the Bible are clearly influenced and derived from earlier stories from civilizations in Mesopotamia and Egypt and tribes around where the Israelites lived. And this all came together and were reworked and retold and emerged in a different form as the Bible.
Why do you think the Bible ends where it does?
Well, it doesn't, you know, it ends where it does. I mean, that's a kind of funny way to ask it, because it only ends in different traditions have it ending in different places. I mean, Jews end it in one place, you know, Protestants end it in another place, Catholics end it in another place. I mean, the order of the books is different. I mean, the historical stories stop for Jews, for the Old Testament, around 400 BC. And I think that's about the time when Jews sort of recover, they get a chance to move back to the Promised Land, and they reestablish themselves and reestablish their civilization. I guess that was the point at which a lot of these books were finally written down and codified. But I don't have a good answer beyond that.
Let's go next to Crowley and speak with Jerry. Hello, Jerry.
Hi. I'm from Crowley. I really appreciate you taking my call. This is a wonderful program. I just had a couple of comments. I'm an atheist. Grew up probably going to the Baptist church and really reading the Bible is what it changed my mind and thoughts. But I do think it would be good to have a class in public school about the Bible, but maybe a historical or a literature point of view. And then also I'd like to say I do have a favorite book in the Bible, which is Ecclesiastes. And that was my comment, and I appreciate the show. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
I love her comment about Ecclesiastes, because Ecclesiastes is, it is the great book for people who are doubting, who are non-believers. I've had several Christian friends of mine come up to me in recent weeks and say, you know, my favorite book of the Bible is Ecclesiastes. Does that mean I'm a bad Christian? I said, that's between you and your pastor. I can't answer that. But my favorite book of the Bible, actually, is there's another book which I think is a great book for people who haven't read the Bible to enter, which is the Book of Ruth, which is just a story of a young woman, young widow, who's a convert to Judaism, who moves back to Judea with her mother-in-law and marries an old bachelor and then has children. Her descendants turn out to be King David, and in the Christian tradition, Jesus is a descendant of hers. And it's a story which is like a Jane Austen novel, in that it takes just a tiny, quiet little domestic drama, and the whole world is contained in that, that you can learn everything you need to know about human nature and human behavior and how to lead a good life just from this tiny little domestic drama. And so that's a story I find myself coming back to and back to and back to, because it is, you know, it captures something fundamental about how families and love work.
So the book really talks about your personal experience as you are reading the Bible and your relationship to the text in the book and to your notion of God. But you've also had this simultaneous experience where for years now you have had a lot of opportunities to talk with complete strangers about the Bible. Have you learned anything based on the way people have responded to you?
Well, I think, you know, first of all, I've learned that Americans love the Bible above all. I mean, I when I was blogging the Bible for Slate, the project that became Good Book, I received 11,000, I think it was when I counted, 11,000 emails, you know, personal emails. You know, these weren't, they were extraordinarily rich and filled with interesting comments and observations and questions. And people, you know, people have a kind of deep warm feeling for it, which I didn't even recognize when I started it, because I wasn't raised in a household where people read the Bible, and I didn't understand that. And then I think that, you know, I do think that the Christian tradition, the evangelical Protestant tradition in this country, of sort of reading the Bible yourself, really having a personal relationship with the book, is really wonderful. I mean, it gives the people a kind of depth of knowledge, which I think those of us who don't come out of that tradition don't get. And then the other thing I've realized is that people are happy to argue about this. That it said, you know, one thing he's always said, oh, don't talk about religion or money at the dinner table. I do think people love to talk about the Bible, and that even people who were kind of insulted by my work or who thought I was wrong about things loved to talk about it, and loved to the notion that we could, you know, that here we are, we're in a society where we're free to believe what we want and practice the religion that we want and have the faith that we want and read whatever holy book that we want. But we can also have a civil and pleasant and interesting discussion about it with each other. That we don't have to be fearful of you know, talking to someone from another faith tradition or with different ideas. And that was glorious.
And in the 10 seconds we have left, when your kids are of age to do this themselves, will you be tempted to sort of guide them through it, or do you want to just turn them loose and let them read it?
I turn them loose. Mm-hmm. Turn them loose, let them ask questions. That's the way to do it.
David Plotz is the editor of Slate Magazine, which originally ran his Blogging the Bible series. His book, based on the experience, is called Good Book, The Bizarre, Hilarious, Disturbing, Marvelous, and Inspiring Things I Learned When I Read Every Single Word of the Bible. David, it's been great. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.